supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Opening statements in the trial of Pennsylvania State Senator Larry Farnese kicked off today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the case will focus on whether a $6,000 gift that Farnese gave was bribery or just a good deed.
Farnese's fate will turn on just how the jury views that $6,000 donation. It happened back in 2011. Farnese was angling to win a ward leader seat. He was already a state senator, but being a ward leader could help him rally his Center City and South Philly base to vote. He made a bunch of calls to ward committee people who elect ward leaders. Farnese was looking for support. And that's how Ellen Chapman got involved. She was one of the ward committee people. Along the way, he found out that Chapman was having money problems. Her daughter in college needed $6,000 to pay for a study abroad program in Kyrgyzstan. Farnese gave her the money, and Chapman voted for him, helping him become ward leader. Did Farnese buy her vote, which would be a crime, or was it just a state senator helping out a constituent? Farnese's attorney said it wasn't a sinister gesture. The timing was just coincidental. Chapman didn't ask for money for her support, and Farnese never intended the donation to influence her vote. But federal prosecutors counter that they have evidence that it was a bribe, including Farnese's former political director, who wrote an email describing it as a donation in exchange for a vote arrangement. He's the government's star witness, and he's expected to take the stand in the coming days. He was originally under investigation by federal prosecutors, but agreed to cooperate with them in exchange for immunity from charges. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Pennsylvania faces a growing budget gap, and to help cut costs, the Department of Corrections will announce the closure of two state prisons on Thursday. Some say the decision is being made hastily, though DOC said as prison populations decline, this is the new normal. Keystone Crossroads' Margaret J. Krause looks at how communities across the state could be affected.
It's been 3 weeks since the Department of Corrections announced five prisons were being considered for closure. State Correctional Institutions Pittsburgh and Mercer in the western part of the state, and Waymart Retreat and Frackville in the east. More than 2,500 prisoners will be relocated to other prisons throughout the state. Over the last 2 years, the state's inmate population dropped by nearly 1,600 people. That reduction allows the Department of Corrections to reshuffle inmates and shutter prisons. Jason Bloom is apprehensive. He's president of the Pennsylvania State Corrections Officers Association. He says the two closures will dangerously stretch prison capacity, as well as correction officers' ability to do their jobs.
You can't continue to shove inmates or stack them like cordwood, as I said, into institutions that are already overpopulation. It's a powder keg, and you're just walking around with a lit cigarette.
Corrections Secretary John Wetzel said at a recent hearing in the Pennsylvania Senate that the remaining prisons will operate at 109% capacity. He said it's not ideal, but his department estimates it can save between $80 and $90 million. This year, the state faces a $600 million budget gap. Next year, that number is $1.7 billion. Democratic State Senator John Udichik represents Luzerne County, where the retreat prison is located. He says the numbers don't add up.
All of the personnel costs, all of the inmate care costs are transferred to another prison. You're not going to see tens of millions of dollars being saved. As a matter of fact, you're going to see overtime budgets go up. That's exactly what happened when they closed two prisons down in 2013. The overtime budget spiked to $90 million.
DOC says the 800 staff affected by the two closures will have the opportunity to work at another state facility. But communities worry their economies will be hard hit. The Frackville prison is the second largest employer in Schuylkill County. Beyond possibly losing their corrections officers and their income tax, secondary businesses could be affected, from restaurants and gas stations to real estate. At a recent community meeting, real estate agent Helen Miernicki says just the rumors the prison might close affected her business.
Matter of fact, I was just out 2 weeks ago showing a prospect of an employee housing, and he decided not to buy because not knowing if he would have a job.
Secretary Wetzel says the department hopes to find a new use for the closed prisons. The buildings are hard to sell, but Wetzel says if the federal government decided to house federal inmates at those prisons, money could continue to flow to nearby communities. Joel Dixon says closing a prison is hard on everyone. Dixon is the former superintendent of the Pittsburgh prison, which was mothballed in 2005 before reopening in 2007.
Well, it was pretty traumatic across the board for not only the staff, but the inmates and families of the staff and the inmates.
The Pittsburgh facility is one of a few prisons that offers inmates specialized mental health and addiction programs and also has a veterans unit. Dixon worries about disrupting those programs. He thinks the state could save money by downsizing the facility rather than closing it. Prisons don't just lock people in their cells, he says. They prepare inmates to re-enter society.
Certainly, the citizenry should be concerned about their tax dollars, but some tax dollars are well spent. More than 90% of these folks are going to come back to live in your neighborhood.
Secretary Wetzel says closing a prison is not something he and his staff take lightly. But the reality of the budget means they have to make tough choices. Margaret J. Krause, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads reporters Emily Previty and Eleanor Klibanoff contributed reporting. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY serves as the lead station. Originally built in 1719, the Francis Tavern in the Wall Street District of New York City served as a meeting place for General George Washington. 42 years ago today, Philadelphia College of Textiles and Science and Wharton MBA grad, as well as Philadelphia-based Roman Haas Chemical Company financial analyst Alex Berger, went there for a lunchtime business meeting. At around 1:25 that afternoon, a bomb blast ripped through the tavern annex. Berger was among four people killed. More than 50 others were injured. Berger left behind family, including his wife, Deanie, who was in 1975, 6 months pregnant with their first child. Deanie, Berger, Edinson, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
You're quite welcome.
Tell us about the man you fell in love with and married.
He was extremely bright, graduated first in his class from textile, and an outstanding athlete, quite handsome, funny, just an all-around terrific person.
Apparently nobody was specifically charged with the precise bombing that took those lives and injured others. Though, President Barack Obama 1 week ago today commuted the sentence of one Oscar Lopez Rivera, who was widely regarded as the person who likely masterminded that bombing. Did you have any preliminary sense that this was about to take place?
I had a sense that it would take place. We went through this in 99 when Clinton actually, in August of 99, granted pardons and clemency to the other members of the FALN who were in prison.
The FALN was a Puerto Rican nationalist group.
Correct. And their objective was to gain independence for Puerto Rico.
Rivera didn't take the terms that went along with that.
He was the only one who did not accept clemency.
What was his pretext for not accepting?
Well, part of it was that he had to renounce terrorism and show some sign of contrition, and he did not.
He was convicted of seditious conspiracy, use of force to commit robbery, interstate transportation of firearms and ammunition to aid in the commission of a felony, and interstate transportation of stolen vehicles. Yet the many who consider him a political prisoner, both in Puerto Rico, Nobel Prize laureates, politicians in the United States, including current mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, where the bombing took place, Vermont senator and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Do you have an understanding of what animates those who champion his cause? Or, much like you stated earlier, do you feel that those who do so don't have a full packet of the facts of the case?
I can only imagine that they don't have the full packet of the case. I had an opportunity to have a meeting with Desmond Tutu. My husband and I met with he and his wife when they were in the New Jersey area for a speaking engagement.
He granted you audience?
He did. He was extremely gracious. He actually shared with us that he had been asked by the Archbishop or Bishop of Puerto Rico, who was a friend, to lend his name to a petition that was being formulated to ask for clemency, pardon, parole, whatever, for Oscar Lopez Rivera. There were a lot of people on that petition who didn't know what they were lending their name to.
In a more general sense, can you understand that mindset which resulted in the commutation of the man who oversaw the bombing that claimed the life of your husband?
I could only understand the mindset if the person had truly changed. At that parole hearing in 2011, he refuted everything, had no contrition.
What next do you want for yourself and other family and friends of Alex?
I know for me, the month of January, beginning to end, is extremely difficult. Especially the timing of this 1 week before the anniversary was just like a knife in the gut all over again. I dread May because when Oscar is released, there will be parades in Chicago, possibly New York, and in Puerto Rico celebrating him as a hero. And he is no hero in any stretch of the definition.
Deanie Berger Ettinson, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
You're quite welcome.
You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. The Free Library of Philadelphia opens its annual citywide reading program tomorrow evening. This year's One Book, One Philadelphia selection is The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's a mystery novel by Mark Haddon, whose main character is a boy with autism. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the reading program starts with a bang.
Every year, the Free Library commissions a composer to write a piece of music related to its One Book, One Philadelphia selection. This year, it asked Nick DiBerardino, a composition student at the Curtis Institute of Music. He was inspired by a particular scene in the book, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The main character, Christopher, enters a train station and becomes highly agitated. The lights, sounds, and commotion of the station is overwhelming. So to calm himself down, he counts through primary numbers. 1, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, etc. DiBerardino wrote this piece so that a drummer is hitting a gong or splashing a cymbal and letting it resonate on its own.
There will be moments where the percussionist hits a gong and a cymbal and there's just this commotion, a lot of sound. For me, that kind of relates to this idea of all this external information that comes in and it's just not even being processed. It's just noise. And then on top of that, there will be layers where the percussionist is actually playing through prime numbers. So he'll go 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
This piece, called Homunculus, has a more avant-garde feel than the very popular Broadway musical that's also based on the book. That will tour through Philadelphia in March. DiBerardino wrote his piece to be performed by a single percussionist who is expected to play 21 instruments, many of them simultaneously, for 6 minutes. He wanted the piece to be its own kind of theater.
All the time, composers are writing for a situation where we hope you're there to see it because there's a special energy. But of course, in percussion music, it's especially direct to that visual element because they're hitting stuff.
Homunculus will be performed exactly once as part of One Book, One Philadelphia, and DiBerardino hopes this piece will follow in the footsteps of previous library commissions that have gone on to be performed again somewhere else. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Drexel's Learning Innovation Program launches at this hour with a speaker series this evening featuring John Maeda, the global head of computational design and inclusion at web developer Automattic. I had opportunity to speak with John earlier in the day. John, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's talk a bit about your background. MIT.
Yep.
Technology. Rhode Island School of Design. Yeah. Art. And you've been at the vanguard of converting STEM to STEAM. I'll let you lay out what those acronyms are and the endeavor to do so.
Yeah. I went to MIT. I wasn't happy with just computer science. I wanted more. So I went to art school after that. I came back to MIT as a professor at a place called the Media Lab. I was tenured. And the problem with tenure is tenured professorships are awesome because you've made it. And then you can never be fired again. And this bothered me. So I left. I felt I wouldn't grow because there was no constraint. There was no need to grow. And my mission is to connect engineering with the arts and business. A lot of my work is helping creative people be less afraid of money. If you're a creative person, you're told to starve. Only if you starve for your work are you, like, honoring your work.
The romance of the starving artist.
I am totally against that. For most of my life as a creative person, I was always told, don't worry about the money, John. I began to wonder, should I be worried about the money? I got my MBA as a result, and in doing so, realized that understanding how capital intersects with creativity and technology unlocks so much possibility.
A big fear of those who might even entertain notions of advancing themselves in STEAM is the fear of technology, and you helped to dispel that with a book called The Laws of Simplicity.
It came out at a time when people were feeling technology was getting a lot more complex. It was pre-mobile phone, too. Mobile has changed everything.
How so?
10 years ago, computers were the tools of nerds. But now the computer is a phone. We somehow forgot that having a computer was nerdly because the phone is what all of us have. And the phone is a computer in our pocket or purse today. And because of that, that same complexity that we used to have on our desktop, we now carry around. So when we're confused as to why this is so hard to use, it's because this is a whole new era. And that's why it's a good time for design, because technologists love to add features because it's exciting to build a feature. Designers should be removing features from things. Why do designers have to remove features? To curate what you should experience.
Draw out that term, curate for experience.
Well, it's kind of like I can imagine you as a curator of voice and ideas. You can pull every fact out of someone, but you're picking and choosing which one might resonate with your audience the best. You understand the audience. If you understand the audience, you can curate for them. Designers think about the audience and build that mapping to them, not to the thing at hand.
So then how do we square this acquisitive society, things, with what you refer to as post-possessionista?
Well, the post-possessionista phrase that I developed or probably appropriated somewhere was I'd moved to Silicon Valley. And I was always in an Uber or Airbnb. This is like 4 years ago, so it was kind of an anomaly. And in doing so, I felt so free. And in that freedom, I realized that the smartphone contains all this experience. And so a post-positionista person can live like that because a smartphone is this meta device that can do almost anything. It's the challenge of educating people to understand how the technology works. Because you look at a smartphone, you crack it open, there's nothing inside there. But it turns out that over the last few decades, what's inside your smartphone is more complex than maybe like a million 747s, especially when it's connected to all the other 747 computers in the world. Imagine a car 30 years ago that went 60 miles per hour. A car today would be going at light speed. That's what's been happening because of the microprocessor revolution.
The power of your message is we're not merely trying to hang on for the ride. We can drive that vehicle.
We can make change if we understand the vehicle. And because access to understanding the vehicle has been locked up by different companies, so you can't look inside to see how it works, that's why I wanted to be at a company where the software is open. You can look inside. Oh, that's where the brake connects to the whatever. Oh, that's what's inside there. Number one. Number two, how do I change the brake? Maybe I can make it work my way. So there you go.
John Maeda, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
John Maeda, Global Head of Computational Design and Inclusion at web developer Automattic. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Finally this evening, WalletHub.com has released a new ranking of the most educated states in America for adults over the age of 25. New Jersey topped the tri-state region, 10th overall. Delaware ranked 17th in the nation. Pennsylvania lagged at 28th. Now, the study used 11 different metrics, including average quality of universities and gender gap in educational attainment. By the way, Massachusetts came in number one, bringing up the rear, West Virginia number 50. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.